He looked down at his magnificent apparel, the same uniform he would wear again when he appeared before the clan leadership in disgrace. In his cabin, Kikrondo changed out of his formal uniform and back into a plain set of fatigues that were more appropriate for a warrior. The neck of the dress uniform must be too tight, he thought, as he pulled the neckline of the fatigues away from his skin and scratched his neck, and scratched it again. It was uncomfortable. He thought of putting a cream on his neck to stop it from...
Admiral!
The comm system in the wall console alerted him. We have a problem! In the engineering control chamber of the destroyer, one of the reactor engineers was also tugging on the collar of his own formal dress uniform, which he still wore. The Admiral had ordered the entire crew to dress formally to receive the Jirattha, who had not even bothered to enter the back half of the ship. The engineering team had their bots scrubbing and cleaning and polishing every surface, even inside areas that could only be accessed by removing hatches. Bots were not good enough for some chores. The crew had gotten on hands and knees to clean and polish manually. Domestic chores such as cleaning were menial tasks for bots, slaves, and females, and humiliating to any Kristang warrior. And after all the painstaking effort, wasted effort, the disgusting, arrogant Jirattha had not looked at any of the engineering spaces, had not even glanced at a single missile to assure its warhead detonation device had been removed. The reactor engineer did not have much to do, as the only active reactor aboard the ship was the small auxiliary power unit. The engineering team had feared the Jirattha would demand even that relatively weak unit be put in cold shutdown before the destroyer attached to the star carrier, leaving the entire ship relying on backup power. Fortunately, even the Jirattha understood that the main reactors could not have their containment systems energized by backup power and allowed the APU to remain online. That is odd, the engineer thought to himself. The console instruments indicated the APU was running slightly warm, despite the coolant system operating perfectly. Then the console shows the temperature of the reactor spiking, and the engineer sniffed the air. Smoke. The three Jirattha climbed up the ramp into their dropship. As soon as the ramp was securely closed, two of them dropped the pretense of being inebriated. Blue Armband had to help Saixi into a seat, because Saixi, still bitter about losing the wager, had actually filled his squeeze bulb with Burgoza.
That was not, Saixi hiccuped. Not as much fun as it could have been.
Be patient, Saixi, Yellow Armband assured his crewmate. I'll wager in a few minutes you will think our little trip was well worth our time.
Yes, Blue Armband agreed, and the two slapped antennas gleefully. I will not take that wager, Saixi muttered morosely. It had better be something damned entertaining to brighten up my day.
What he had not mentioned was that he had just lost another bet, a bet about the Kristang Admiral's attire. Saixi had wagered the disgraced Kristang would wear regular shipboard fatigues to show disdain for and defiance of the Jirattha. He had lost, because Kikrondo, indeed every crewman aboard the destroyer, had been wearing full dress uniform. The dropship was less than halfway back to the star carrier when they received notice of a potentially serious problem aboard the Kristang flagship. Fire in an auxiliary reactor. The destroyer was preparing to maneuver and possibly eject the reactor core from the ship. All ships in the area were warned to avoid a radioactive explosion. To the confusion of Saixi, his companions were chuckling, then laughing uncontrollably.
We had better,
Yellow Armband said between gales of laughter.
Tell them before they really do eject it.
What did you do?
Saixi asked, checking that he was securely held in the seat in case the dropship had to perform emergency maneuvers.
An old classic, Saixi. Sometimes the best tricks are the simple ones. Smoke bomb in the reactor compartment. We dropped nanobots that crawled through their ventilation system to their engineering spaces. By now they think the auxiliary reactor is overheating and the compartment should be filled with smoke. Oh, I wish I could see their ugly faces when they realize it is only a simple smoke bomb.
Saixi chuckled also. He had to admit that was a good one.
I am glad I did not take your wager. I love messing with the Kristang. They are so gullible.
Wait,
Blue Armband struggled to say. He was laughing so hard.
Wait until the Admiral discovers the itching powder in his uniform fatigues. Another oldie but goodie. I tell you, when messing with a low-tech species, simple tricks are the best.
Admiral Cacrondo received an all-clear from the destroyer's captain, who was chagrined to admit the problem had been only a smoke bomb. A simple, practical joke that had the destroyer's crew less than 30 seconds from ejecting the reactor core, before an engineer discovered the smoke-generating device behind a pipe. Admiral Cacrondo's acknowledgement was delayed, as he was in the shower, furiously scrubbing his itching skin, and hoping whatever else fate had in store for him, that he never again had to deal with the Giraptha. 39 Commander's Jacquard completed its long flight, and the pilots set it down as close to the objective as possible. The wings of the Jacquard bent or broke tree branches, and the belly of the dropship flattened one small tree and several shrubs. That could not be prevented. The commando leader was the first to pop the door open and breathe in blessedly fresh air, filling his lungs in great, greedy gulps. To enhance stealth, the air circulation inside the Jacquard had been kept at a minimum, and the air in the cabin had been stale and increasingly thick with the stink of unwashed Kristang warriors. The commando leader walked down the steps onto the stony, sandy soil. His boots crunched on dried leaf litter from the palm trees, which swayed in the steady trade winds. His second-in-command walked down to stand beside him.
Ah, that air is a relief. It's too bad we're here on a mission. This island would be a pleasant place to relax.
Relax? Without females to serve us? The leader scoffed, but winked at his second.
It is nice, he said, enjoying the hot sun on his skin. I will have to remember this place after we take this planet back from the Ruhar. If we are successful, the second chuckled, this island won't be here.
True.
Then the leader snapped out of his brief tropical reverie. Stealth netting goes up first, then set up jammers and repeaters. Get those trees, he pointed to the branches broken by the Jacquard's descent, trimmed, and bend some of these palms down to lean over the ship. The palms were tall enough. I'm going to inspect the site. He scuffed away soil with the heel of his boot. Perhaps fortune will smile on us, and this will be easy.
This is a volcanic island,
the second repeated data from the geological survey.
It could be all hardened lava under this sand.
If it is, the leader said sourly, I will blame your negative thoughts.
Chapter 8
Got it. Trace reacquired,
the Memhertal's sensor technician muttered excitedly. He was too tired to shout, having been awake almost continuously while his ship tracked the extremely faint particle trail left by what he was certain was the Kristang frigate to seek glory in battle as glorious.
Tagging location. Bring us about again, he advised the duty officer. We need to triangulate the trace.
Bring us about again. The duty officer wearily ordered the ship's helmsman. Again. How many times had they done that already? She could not remember. Even the ship's computer may have lost track of how many times they had performed the same repetitive action. Knowing the duty officer and the entire crew were bored out of their minds, the sensor tech stood up, stretched, then announced,
Particle density was up another 18% that time. We're closing.
The duty officer rose from her chair excitedly.
You are sure?
The tech pointed to the display.
See for yourself, ma'am.
How close?
The Hertal had been coordinating the search with the Toman and the Grathur. Each of the three ships wanted to do everything they could to find a dangerous enemy, and the crew of each ship wanted their own ship to be the one who found the glory. So far, the Memhertal was significantly in the lead. The tech rubbed the back of his aching neck.
Close. With this level of particle density, that ship must have significant battle damage. She is spewing out reactor coolant. She has a leaky airlock. And her hull coating is flaking off.
From the hull coating alone, the database can be certain we're tracking our old friend, the Glory.
Close, like?
The duty officer asked anxiously. The ship was now only on yellow alert, the highest condition of combat readiness that could be sustained for a long period. If combat was imminent, she should take the ship to red alert. Or Captain Rostall, who was sleeping in his cabin next to the bridge, should do that.
Should I notify the captain?
The sensor tech held up a finger for quiet as the Hertal crossed the trace cloud from a different direction.
Got it. Up 22%, and the trail is straight as an arrow. Now, you should wake up the captain.
The Kristang Special Forces Warriors of 39 Commando prepared a stealth communications drone. Folded up for deployment, the device was no larger than a walnut shell, but surprisingly heavy as it consisted of tightly packed nanomaterial. The Kristang Special Forces were in luck that day, or they had been smart enough to wait for the afternoon trade winds to pick up, for a stiff and steady breeze blew out of the west. To launch the stealth drone, two Kristang handled a thin tube that extended out to 10 meters length. A magnetic impulse launched the walnut, which grew guidance fins after it left the launch tube. When it reached peak altitude at 1,800 meters and began to fall, the fins retracted and the outer shell exploded away, revealing a gossamer-thin parachute. At the center of the steerable parachute, the communications drone was now the size of a lima bean and encased in a fuzzy stealth field. To wrap even such a tiny object in stealth took enormous power, and the drone's life was limited to 13 hours. That was much more time than needed, if nothing went drastically wrong. The brain of the drone steered the parachute to catch uplifting winds and avoid downdrafts. It was carried far from the island, climbing higher and higher on soaring thermals, until it reached the point where the air was too thin to provide additional lift. At that point, the parachute material reformed itself into a tall, thin balloon, and the drone filled the balloon with heated hydrogen gas. It climbed rapidly, then its ascent slowed, with the balloon's envelope expanding as the atmosphere fell away. When the drone judged it could rise no higher, it squirted its message into space on a laser beam with less than 2 milliseconds duration. Then the drone self-destructed gently into a fine powder. It would take the powder months to fall to the surface, far across the surface of the ocean. Because the laser beam was initiated so high above the surface, there were few atmospheric particles to create backscatter. Sensors on a Ruhar satellite detected only the faintest trace of a signal, which the sensor network dismissed as most likely being caused by a cosmic ray or micrometeorite. The laser beam, in the vacuum of space, traveled outward on its lonely journey, encountering only the occasional particle propelled by the solar wind of Paradise's star. 30 minutes later, the beam's strength was still 86% of its original power, well above the 22% needed to be successfully read by a Kristang frigate. The battered and overworked little frigate Glory had been loitering at the signal rendezvous point 30 light minutes from the planet the Kristang knew as Perdassus. The hair-thin laser beam was intercepted by the frigate's extended sensor field, causing that ship's captain to congratulate his navigator's precision. If their position in deep space had been off by as little as the height of a Kristang warrior, they would have missed the signal. The captain privately thought their ability to intercept the signal was a miracle, or luck, rather than precision. The Glory's captain read the message and frowned. The ship's second-in-command read the message and groaned.
"Sir," the second officer protested quietly, "this will require extremely precise timing and navigation to jump into an area this small."
He meant the small sphere of space above Perdassus where the Glory was supposed to rendezvous with the Jacquard dropship of 39 Commando.
"With the poor condition of our jump drive, we would need to jump in close to the planet, then make a second short jump to the rendezvous point. That is the only way we could have hope of jumping into an area this precise."
The captain clapped his second officer on the back with a hearty Kristang warrior slap.
"Ha! You joke, Smondo. This ship's obsolete jump drive could not bring us into these coordinates if we were already there. Krell." He used a Kristang curse word. "We will be lucky not to emerge from jump inside the damned planet. No matter," he sighed. We have our orders. At least we know where and when this mission will end, one way or another.
Captain, Second Officer Smondo said with a forced smile. Sometimes his captain's gallows humor was too much to take.
We will need to hit the rendezvous with a second jump. We will lose the advantage of surprise. 39 Commando will need to fly their Jacuar directly into our landing bay without delay. We have to jump away within 40 seconds.
40? The captain raised a skeptical eyebrow.
30 seconds, I think. The Ruhar sensor network is still only partly established around Perdassus, but from what little we have been able to observe, their response time is impressive.
30 seconds? Smondo clenched his teeth. That was impossibly quick.
Do not worry, Smondo.
The captain pounded his underling on the back again.
I have some ideas on how to buy us time. Enough time? Perhaps not. This ship has tempted fate far too many times already. At this point, the suspense of not knowing when we will die is killing me. Better to get it over with, eh?
Smondo's lips twisted into a weak grin.
Yes, sir.
He wondered again for the 1,000th time why he had not taken his father's advice and requested a nice shore assignment. To seek glory in battle was indeed glorious. It was also dangerous. If he somehow survived his term of service aboard the Glory, he would put his career ambitions aside for a time and simply enjoy being alive. If he lived that long. It was a long, long flight, mostly over water. The flight was tiring for Irene and Derek, mostly because their flying was constantly criticized by the Ruhar pilots who were flying the lead buzzard. The criticism was particularly annoying because for most of the flight, the humans had their buzzard on autopilot, guided by signals from the lead ship.
Tunnal, fall back 2.27 kilometers. You are crowding me, called the Ruhar pilot in the lead ship. And you are low. Climb 1,800 meters to the glide path.
Asshole,
Irene muttered under her breath and pointed to the main cockpit display that was projected onto the windshield.
We are exactly on the freaking glide path, and 0.8 kilometer separation is textbook flight procedure for a two-ship formation at this speed and altitude.
Derek knew nothing he said would soothe his pilot's anger. He said it anyway.
He's not unhappy with your flying. He objects that we are humans. Nothing we do will be good enough for him.
Fortunately, the buzzard had plenty of fuel to reach the island with a comfortable safety margin. They would not need to perform in-flight refueling until the flight back. At that point in the mission, the giant maser projector would be online, and no one would care how skillfully the humans performed on the return flight. After drilling down to the projector control chamber, there wouldn't be much for the humans to do. Derek was hoping they would find time to relax on one of the beautiful white sand beaches of the island and go swimming. He had researched whether swimming in the oceans of paradise was safe, because there were predators in the water. Each of the humans had a Ruhar device they could wear around their waists that would deter predators, and Nert assured him he was looking forward to swimming. Derek was looking forward to seeing Irene in a bikini. Or less. Irene cocked her head at her co-pilot, for him having stated the obvious.
Yeah, like I said, he's an asshole.
She keyed the console to respond.
Understood, Kiwi, we'll comply.
She pulled back on the yoke to initiate a climb.
The lead pilot's call sign is Kliwa, not Kiwi,
Nert chided her gently from the jump seat behind her.
The call sign they gave us is Tunnal. That is the baby chick of a bird known for flying awkwardly on your home planet, right?
Irene asked without turning to look at their liaison officer.
Yes, that is
Oh, ha ha. The translator explained to me that a kiwi is an earth bird that is incapable of flying.
Nert giggled.
That is funny.
Yes.
Irene regretted being flippant. This mission wasn't about reactivating another projector. It was about building trust with the Ruhar. Insulting a Ruhar pilot was not a tactic likely to build a positive relationship.
I shouldn't have said that. Sorry.
There's no need to be sorry, Lieutenant Strebik,
Nert giggled again.
He did indeed insult you with that call sign. You are right to give it back to him. As you stated, he is an asshole. The next time you speak with him, tell him fuck you very much,
Nert said with a jaw-stretching grin. Irene and Derek couldn't help laughing. It was good to see their young liaison officer had a healthy sense of humor about himself. Against her better judgment, Irene pulled back on the control stick to initiate a climb, pulling her buzzard higher and far behind the lead ship. The Ruhar wanted space to fly? Fine. Irene would give it to him. She waited until she was 10 kilometers behind and 1,000 meters higher. The Ruhar pilot did not object. Or he didn't care.
There it is, Derek called excitedly from the right-hand seat, sitting up straight in his seat and craning his neck to see over the console.
He toggled the intercom open.
The island is dead ahead of us if anyone wants a view. We're passing a chain of similar islands to our right.
The islands were even more beautiful than they appeared in pictures. Lush, tropical peaks surrounded with white sand beaches, brilliantly blue water, and fringing reefs. Derek couldn't wait to get the drilling over with and hit the beach.
Tunal, orbit here while I circle the island and select 2 landing areas, the lead pilot ordered.
Understood, Keeley, Irene said with a tight smile,
pulling the buzzard into a tight turn so she was flying circles over a peninsula that stuck out like a finger into the azure water.
The landing area for my ship needs clearance for us to unload the drill rig.
The lead pilot could land in a clearing barely large enough for his ship, and he probably would do that to show off. Irene required space to get the drill rig out the back ramp and attach it to the sling so she could carry it to the projector site.
I know that, Tunal, the Ruhar snapped, irritated.
He's jealous that he doesn't have the skill to hover with the drill rig in a sling, Irene muttered to Derek.
It's going to be tricky in this wind, Derek observed unhappily, watching the palm trees ripple and sway in the strong winds. I'm reading the wind fluctuating between 8 and 10 meters per second. Compared to the katabatic wind on our first Arctic mission, that's nothing. On this mission, we don't have any margin for error, Derek reminded his fellow pilot.
They were not only too far away to quickly get spare parts if they broke anything. Major Perkins had explained in confidence to her pilots that this could very well be humanity's last mission for the Ruhar. They absolutely could not afford to screw anything up.
Yeah, yeah, Irene waved a hand dismissively. We'll use a guide cable anchored to the ground and winch the rig down. Piece of cake. Asshole up there is going to be disappointed if he is hoping to watch us make a mistake.
Irene flipped a middle finger toward the windscreen at the lead ship.
Lieutenant Strebik, you feel strong romantic affection for the lead pilot?
Nert expressed surprise from the jump seat behind Irene.
What? For that jerk?
She turned in her seat to glance at their liaison officer.
No. But,
Nert sputtered, confused.
You made a gesture to initiate mating.
I did
Nert continued.
Is not your middle finger a human gesture meaning fuck you?
Oh, God. Derek broke into laughter as Irene's face grew beet red.
He is right, Irene. You're sweet on your Kiwi boy up there.
I am
she never finished. Derek held up a hand.
I just lost external sensors, he reported with alarm. I can't see the lead ship with the sensor field. And
he looked at Irene, eyes wide open.
We lost satellite guidance. We're not receiving the navigation signals.
Is it us?
We're not receiving anything?
Irene scanned the console, seeking sign of a problem with the buzzard's antennas.
I don't see any.
Ahead of them, over the center peak of the island, a bright burning streak shot up from the tree cover, striking the lead ship in the belly directly below where the wings attached. The Ruhar's buzzard blew apart in an orange fireball, pieces raining down widely over the island. Irene reacted instantly, throwing her buzzard into a full power dive. The cockpit computer's bitchin' Betty was shouting warnings at her. Usually, the computer-generated voice called out semi-useful alerts like, "Terrain, pull up," or "Power loss and starboard engine." This time, the voice was shouting a "Missile inbound" warning that Irene found completely freaking obvious, so she ignored it.
Hang on back there, she said into the intercom. This is going to get kinetic in a hurry.
Derek's teamwork was perfect. He engaged the ship's stealth field, anti-missile active countermeasures, and defensive maser turrets. Those actions, and their distance from the mountain peak where 39 Commando was hiding, were almost enough. Almost. Irene chopped power and flared to avoid smacking into the surface of the sea, intending to hug the tree cover of the shoreline until the highest mountain peak was masked by the smaller peak of the island. The buzzard roared just above the waves, no more than 20 meters from the beach, when Derek called out a warning.
Three missiles inbound!
Irene pulled the buzzard toward the beach, racing barely above the waves. She slammed the engines into full reverse, and the buzzard stood on its nose before swinging the engines quickly back down into a hover. With both engines scouring sand off the beach, she tucked the aircraft between tall palm trees to slide to a rough landing, the skids gouging long furrows in the sparklingly white sand. If they got hit, she did not want to be moving fast or over water. Best to be on the ground, where the enemy missile's sensors might be confused by ground clutter. And maneuvering the awkward, lumbering transport aircraft at low speed was useless against missiles. The stealth and countermeasures either worked or they did not. They almost did. One missile got confused by ripples in the sea surface where the buzzard's belly jets had disturbed the water. That missile impacted the surface, plunged into the sandy bottom, and exploded, throwing a fountain of sand, mud, saltwater, and sea creatures skyward. The second missile slowed its approach to evaluate the cloud of water spray thrown up by the first missile. Its hesitation gave the buzzard's defensive maser turrets time to lock on, and two turrets combined to burn through the nose of the missile, frying its brain and rendering it inert. That missile continued forward on momentum alone, crashing through trees a half kilometer beyond the motionless buzzard. Unfortunately, the third missile detected the defensive maser fire and homed in on that location. The maser turrets switched their focus to the third missile, hindered by that missile approaching from an angle where one turret couldn't fire as it was behind the buzzard's tail. The third missile was exploded by a maser beam 80 meters from the buzzard. The high-velocity shaped charge of warhead shrapnel struck the buzzard, tearing into one idling engine, and hot chunks of debris peppered the fuselage.
"Damage report!"
Major Perkins shouted once pieces of hot shrapnel had stopped bouncing about the cabin.
"Starboard engine took a hit. I don't know how bad yet," Irene reported from the cockpit. "It shut down automatically before it tore itself apart. We've got damage to multiple flight control systems, a couple power cells."
She looked back at Perkins.
"The starboard engine is the big problem. It's probably scrap. I won't know until I can look inside."
That wasn't great. It also wasn't the total disaster Perkins had feared.
"Is anyone injured?"
No one had any injury worse than minor cuts from flying shrapnel. They had been saved by the armor around the passenger cabin.
"Everyone out,"
Perkins ordered, worried there might be another missile on its way to them. Hearing Major Perkins's order to abandon ship, Irene moved as quickly as she could, given the somewhat awkward seat release mechanism that was designed for larger Ruhar bodies. She had complained several times about the compromised ergonomics of the buzzard cockpit setup, and now one item had the potential to kill her. She got the straps released, and the side bolsters of the seat automatically slid down, with the center control stand between the seats retracting forward to clear a path for her and Derek. That was all great, and much better than any human-built mechanism could have done. The problem was the nanofabric parachute that the entire team wore as a fanny pack around their waists. The Ruhar parachute was incredible technology, able to protect the wearer in a high-speed bailout. The parachute's computer was smart enough to adjust to the generally smaller size of humans, even Irene's petite frame. She still had the issue of the parachute's strap being too long, so that when she had the damned thing properly cinched around her waist, a loop hung down, creating a snag hazard that would never be allowed for a Ruhar pilot. Irene had suggested trimming the excess material, but the loop was integral to the nanofabric storage, so the Ruhar had not allowed that. Now the loop was snagged on part of the central control stand, trapping her. With a lack of patience that would surprise no one who knew her, she yanked her combat knife out of a boot and sawed through the tough nanofabric with the blade she always kept razor sharp. It felt good to finally be rid of that annoyance.
"Let's go,"
she ordered Derek, who had been waiting for her anxiously, his own knife ready to assist. They ran away from the buzzard, stumbling over rocks and tree roots into the forest, headed for higher ground. A thin trail of gray smoke rose from the stricken engine, wafting barely above the treetops before being carried away by the steady trade winds.
10 minutes should do it, ma'am, Irene advised. If they don't attack again in 10 minutes, they think we're already dead.
3 missiles were fired at us,
Nert said through the Z-phone translator, which always made the young cadet sound older.
We should be dead. Lieutenant Strebik, that was smart to land the aircraft. That is not a technique in our flight training. You saved our lives.
His face reflected admiration. Irene looked at the ground, embarrassed by the praise.
I figured we had zero chance in the air, and if we got hit, I'd rather already be on the ground. I wish we'd had time to evac before that last missile hit.
I don't think so.
Jesse used a knife to dig a still-warm piece of shrapnel out of a palm tree trunk. He held the jagged fragment up for the others to see.
I wouldn't want to be out here when that warhead exploded. The buzzard's cabin is armored.
Specialist Coulter is correct,
Nert agreed with the overbite expression that was the Ruhar version of a frown.
Why here?
Shauna shook her head, dazed. Minutes ago, she had been looking forward to swimming in the spectacularly aquamarine waters, wearing a bikini for the first time in many months, relaxing in the tropical sunshine, maybe finding a secluded beach where she and Jesse would have some private fun.
Yeah. What the hell happened?
Dave's mind was still reeling.
Strebik, what's the POO for those missiles?
Perkins asked about the point of origin.
Just below the highest peak, ma'am,
Irene reported.
They were all toggled off from the same area.
Whoever they are, they're here for the Maser projector then,
Perkins declared, a hand flying to her mouth as she realized the full horror of the situation.
The question is not why or what, Perkins announced. The question is when. Why now?
Nert gasped and finished her thought for her.
The transports...
2 Ruhar transport ships jumped into orbit early yesterday, Perkins explained. The Kristang must be working to get this projector operational so they can use it against those ships.
How the fuck, Perkins thought, had Ruhar intelligence missed a Kristang combat team? A team capable of flying across the ocean, a team large and well-equipped enough to attempt to dig down and reactivate a Maser projector.
The official intelligence reports the Ruhar had shared with UNFHQ stated emphatically that every single Kristang had been evacuated off the surface. Rumant, the unofficial gossip, had been going around for weeks that the Ruhar military was chasing ghosts around the planet, looking for a Kristang commando unit. The Ruhar had flatly denied any such rumors. But now Emily Perkins had a breaking news flash for them. The Kristang were still on Paradise, and still dangerous.
The transports arrived yesterday, and the Kristang haven't shot at them, Derek noted.
The Kristang haven't been able to get the projector working yet?
How many people are aboard those transports? Shauna asked.
39,864,
Nert shouted through the translator, with the device being annoyingly precise as usual.
We must warn them.
I tried that already,
Perkins held up her Z-phone. The island is under a stealth field, and they're jamming all outbound signals.
I tried the comm system in the buzzard,
Irene shook her head.
Nothing's going out.
The Ruhar must have seen the crash, right?
Jesse suggested.
Or hey, the Ruhar will know something is wrong when we don't report in.
Major Perkins shook her head.
Good thinking, but the Kristang will have picked up our transmission on the way in, and they'll be mimicking our signals. No one outside will know anything is wrong here until it's too late.
She wondered what type of Kristang unit they had stumbled across. Whoever they were, they had to be pissed off that a pair of buzzards had flown out of nowhere and almost landed in their laps. Anti-aircraft missiles, a stealth field powerful enough to cover an island and beyond, jammers, signal maskers, and some sort of gear for excavating down to a projector and taking control of it. This was no amateur group of Kristang who had lingered behind and hidden during the evacuation. Perkins realized her team was facing a determined and capable adversary, and her team had not a single weapon between them, not even Nert. Nert held Perkins's forearm and pleaded with her in plain English, using his halting knowledge of the language.
You need stop, Kristang.
I would like to, Nert. She squeezed his hand reassuringly. We do not have any weapons to fight them with. To her team, she shook her head. This is one hell of a soup sandwich, people. We are black on everything useful. It was impossible to make a sandwich out of soup, although that task might be easier than attacking Kristang without using any weapons. Shauna and Dave looked at each other at the same time. We do have a weapon, Shauna said with confidence. The drill rig, ma'am, she explained. How's that, Jarrett? Perkins asked. The Kristang, whoever they are, have been digging down to reactivate this projector, right? Somehow they would have dug or drilled down from the top the shortest distance. They only need access to the control center. But we have a real drill rig. She regarded her toy with affection. Why would we drill down to the control center if the Kristang already have access to it? Derek asked, puzzled. They must have access by now, if they're going to hit transport ships in a few hours. Derek assumed the Kristang would act before the transport ships docked with the top of the space elevator and began unloading passengers. The space station at the top of the elevator was almost over the horizon from the island. It would be a difficult shot for the projector. It would be more effective for the Kristang to hit the two ships while they were maneuvering overhead. We're not going to the control center. Look. Shauna pulled up a schematic of a Mazer projector on her Z-phone. At the base of every projector are power cells, big banks of power cells loaded with energy. If we use the smallest drill bit, she opened her palm to show a drill bit thinner than a pencil, we can reach those power cells. Won't the Kristang figure out what we're doing and stop us? We'll have to set up the drill rig close to them, Perkins worried. No, ma'am, we won't. Jesse was bursting with enthusiasm for Shauna's idea. Shauna is right. We don't have to drill only vertically. This thing can drill a horizontal bore. It can even drill upward. We can steer the drill bit. We can't do it from way out here. Jesse looked around. No, Shauna agreed. We will need to get the rig closer, but ma'am, the Kristang won't know what we're doing until the drill bit gets close to the power cells. When they do, she frowned. We'll need to be ready for them. All right, Perkins considered the idea. You can knock the power cells offline by drilling into them? No, ma'am. There's too many of them, and they're in clusters around the base of the Mazer projector. Even one bank of power cells is enough for a Mazer shot. We would need to take all of them offline, Shauna explained. But what we can do is cause a bank of power cells to overload and rupture. We can clutch together a surge inducer. I know how to do that, she added with an ironic grin, because that is in the big list of things MB warned us not to do around a projector. An overload could destroy the projector? Perkins asked hopefully. Shauna grimaced. That could destroy this whole island. The explosion of one bank would trigger release of energy from the entire array. That is, according to one of the Ruhar I talked with on our last mission. That is not optimal for us, Perkins stated the obvious. Shauna held up her hands. It's an all-or-nothing thing, ma'am. Once one cell overloads, all that stored energy has to go somewhere. It will rupture the other banks of cells. Perkins considered the entire island erupting in a ginormous explosion. Ah, the good news is we don't have to worry about target identification. If it's on this island, and it's not us, we can light it up. I would rather not get blown up with the lizards. Once we reach power cells with the drill bit, we could set the surge inducer to trigger later, Jesse suggested. Set it on a timer. Give us time to get away. To where? Dave swung his arms around. We're on an island. There are other islands around here. Jesse pointed to the sea where islands dotted the horizon. We can use the emergency inflatable boats from the Buzzard. Head for another island. Perkins rubbed the back of her neck. If this island blows up, it will create a tsunami. Irene pursed her lips in thought. That's still better than being here. The boats have electric motors. We could get to one of those islands, go on the other side, or climb high enough to be clear of a tsunami. Unless someone has a better idea. No one did. Jarrett, Perkins pulled out her own Z-phone. Annoyingly, it still had no connection to the outside world, but the map function still worked. And she had stored extensive data about the island, especially its subsurface geology. Show me where we need to put the drill rig in order to reach the power cells. This discussion is academic unless we can get the drill rig in place. There are no roads on this island. Shauna huddled with Dave and Jesse to find a place they could drive the drill from their current location. Irene had rejected any possibility the buzzard could move the drill rig anywhere. Even if the buzzard by some miracle could get in the air, no way could it hover with the drill rig suspended on a sling below. The only way they could move anywhere was for the drill rig to move on its own 6 articulated legs. "Here, ma'am," Shauna announced after 10 fevered minutes of searching for a location the drill rig could walk to that also was close enough to the power cells. "We should be able to walk the drill rig up this riverbed. The tree cover is thinner there." Perkins raised her eyebrows. "You can drill all the way to the power cells from that spot?" The projector was built into the extinct volcano that was the tallest mountain on the island. From the location Shauna had selected, they would be drilling mostly horizontally into the base of the mountain. "Yes," Shauna nodded confidently. "According to the specs in the manual, we can easily reach the power cells from that location. The nanomaterial of the drill pipes can stretch a lot. We'll be drilling a very small diameter hole, so we have plenty of material. And with a small drill bit, we can go fast." "You trust the manual?" Perkins was skeptical. They were dealing with extremely advanced alien technology, but she could not imagine their portable drill rig punching such a long distance through the volcanic rock of the island. "It's been right about everything so far, ma'am. There are a couple possible locations. I suggest we go to this site because there's a seam of softer rock part of the way. We can drill faster there and the vibration won't transmit as far." Perkins examined the data. "Is there really a seam or is that an illusion created by the projector's stealth field?" The network of projectors had remained hidden for centuries because each projector was encased in a stealth field that fooled scanners. Instead of sensors seeing a giant machine beneath the surface, sensors had seen uninteresting dirt, or rock, or whatever had been at that site before the Kristang dug it out to install a projector. "I don't know," Shauna hesitated, unsure. "I'm not a geologist, ma'am," she admitted. "That's all right, Jared, I'm not one either," Perkins said. "This seam does look like it runs right up to the surface. If it's there when we get there, we can assume it goes deeper." "Okay, I'm sold. Get the drill rig out of the buzzard and make it mobile." She contemplated the map on her Z-phone. "We've never walked a drill rig that far." "No, ma'am," Shauna agreed. "Because we're only going to drill a really narrow hole, we can leave a lot of the heavier components here. That will help it walk through the rough terrain here. We can make it." "All right, it's been 10 minutes, Perkins declared. "Back to the buzzard. We've got a hell of a lot of work to do, fast." While they worked to get the drill rig unstrapped, out of the buzzard, set up and tested, Perkins mulled over a problem in her mind. "Strebik, Bonsu, we may need your bird to make a short flight." Irene looked shocked. Surely Major Perkins could see the damage to the aircraft.
"That would be very short, ma'am. I don't think it could reach the water from here. What kind of flight are you planning?"
Perkins turned to Shauna, the team's de facto drill rig expert.
"Jarrett, you said that if we are able to drill into the power cells, the Kristang at some point will know what we're doing." "Yes. Projectors have sensors in the soil around them to detect intrusions and problems like water seepage. It depends on how well the surrounding soil transmits vibration from our drill bit. My guess is the Kristang will know something is wrong once we're within 50 meters of the power cells. At that point, the Kristang will come looking for us and blow up the drill rig," Perkins declared.
"You think they can get to the drill rig that quickly, ma'am?" Dave asked.
"Kristang can move fast, sure. What I think is," Perkins explained, "that they have an aircraft stashed around here somewhere. They sure didn't swim all the way here. I suspect they haven't used their aircraft against us yet because they think they shot us down and we're out of the fight. There's no reason for them to risk their aircraft, and they don't know we don't have anti-aircraft missiles with us. or any weapons of any kind, Perkins thought bitterly. You can be sure that when the Krestang figure out we're trying to blow the projector's power cells, their aircraft will be all over us. We need to find it first and take it out.
Our Busset doesn't have any weapons, ma'am, Irene reminded her commanding officer.
The defensive Mazer turrets didn't count. They could only be used against missiles that threatened the Buzzard.
If it falls out of the sky onto the enemy, our Buzzard is a weapon, Perkins said with a smile.
Oh. Irene was crestfallen. The Ruhar trusted her with a special aircraft, and she had already gotten it shot up. Now she was supposed to deliberately crash it?
You can fly it remotely, correct?
Perkins knew the answer was yes.
We can control it remotely, Irene answered unhappily.
This engine won't fly at all, Irene protested while pointing to the shrapnel pockmarked starboard engine nacelle, with Derek nodding agreement.
We can draw power from the other engine, but this engine can't provide lift or thrust. There are fan blades missing or bent.
She tapped the engine cowling. Dave hopped up to grab the lip of the intake cowling. He slipped the first time, then got a firm hold the second time. He could see what the pilots meant. Many of the fan blades were a mess.
Lieutenant Strebick, how many fan blades do you need to take off with?
I'm not sure. Irene glanced to Derek. That data was probably something they could calculate using the Buzzard's pilot manual.
We only need a short flight, I think, Dave asked.
These bent fan blades. I'm pretty sure I can cut them away, he offered hopefully. Derek looked to Irene, considering the idea.
Whatever blades are left, they'll need to be balanced.
Balanced enough, Irene mused, reluctantly warming to the idea of her precious aircraft flying one last mission.
It will only be a short flight, like he said. We can deal with vibration. We'll override the safeties. Flying the ship remotely, we won't get any seat-of-the-pants feedback. I could set up a vibration sensor, Derek offered.
Irene tilted her head, amused.
Derek, I don't need my backside vibrating to fly a Buzzard.
Major, she turned to Perkins.
I think it's worth a shot. If we can't get the engine balanced, we don't lose anything.
Except time and effort, Perkins reflected unhappily.
Chica, I appreciate the offer to work on the engine, but we need you on the drill if we're going to get it running.
We, Derek pointed to himself and Irene, can handle cutting away the busted fan blades. Derek didn't want to trust a non-pilot to do that task anyway. Irene and Derek were cutting away fan blades and testing the starboard engine, which was still vibrating terribly even at idle. Shauna, Jesse, and Dave had taken the stripped-down drill rig on a long walk, first along the beach, then up a stream bed into the interior of the island. The rig had sustained damage from the Krestang missile, but Shauna knew it was still functional. Emily Perkins was not a pilot or aircraft mechanic or familiar with the operation of the drill rig. She did have a long career as an intelligence analyst before MB enlisted her into reactivating centuries-old alien hyperweapons. Using her experience as an analyst, she reviewed sensor data and images collected by the Buzzard on their brief flight over the island, searching for a hidden Krestang aircraft. The enemy aircraft was almost certainly enveloped in a stealth field, a fact she confirmed by the simple reason that no aircraft was visible anywhere on the island. Between images from their own Buzzard and those transmitted through data link from the lead ship before it was destroyed, she could see nearly 90% of the island. The images and sensor data covered 100% of the mountain and the buried projector, and she concentrated her search there. The Krestang would have sought a landing site as close to the projector as possible to minimize the distance they had to carry whatever equipment they used to dig down to the projector control chamber. Perkins felt it safe to assume the Krestang, whoever they were, did not just happen to carry a portable drill rig with them. However they were getting access to the projector control chamber, they were very likely doing it with improvised equipment. Lasers, even explosive shape charges. That meant a lot of heat being generated. Yet the two Buzzards had not detected anything unusual during the flight in. Or had they?
Damn it. Yes, they had, Perkins saw.
The Krestang no doubt had camouflage netting and a stealth field concealing the site they were excavating, and halted activity when they detected the buzzards approaching. The buzzards had shared a data link, and the pilots had been communicating frequently, making it easy for the Krestang to detect them long before they approached the island. The warning the Krestang had received had been enough time for the excess heat to dissipate, and most of the remaining heat had been masked by the stealth field. Yet sensors on the buzzards had noticed a heat signature, which had been tagged as nothing unusual on a volcano. If the crews had been paying attention, they might have asked why an extinct volcano was generating heat. Perkins did not fault her crew or the Ruhar. This part of the planet was poorly surveyed, being so far from civilization. It was an understandable mistake, though a fatal one. Okay. So now she knew where the Krestang had a stealth field operational. That meant she could examine the characteristics of their stealth field, and look for another stealth field somewhere near the projector. Great idea. Except it didn't work. With the sensor data she had access to, she couldn't find anything. Nothing. Nada. Zilch. Fine. Forget about fancy alien technology. She would go back to basic techniques. The Krestang needed a place to land their aircraft. She looked for clearings near the projector excavation site, moving outward in circles. There were only 4 clearings large enough to land a buzzard-sized aircraft within 2 kilometers of the projector. Damn it. None of the 4 sites showed any sign of anything concealed under netting and inside a stealth field. Which was not surprising. That was the point of camouflage netting and stealth fields. None of the 4 sites were comfortably large enough to land a buzzard with much clearance for safety. Perkins knew her 2 pilots would confidently tell her they could easily set a buzzard down with mere inches to spare. The Krestang pilots were at least as skilled. However, no pilot could prevent downwash from the jets from disturbing the surrounding trees. Aha. Got you, you bastard, she muttered delightedly. The largest of the 4 clearings, the 1 second closest to the projector site, had tree limbs that were limp and turning brown. They must have been broken by the aircraft as it landed. As Perkins examined the images, she whistled. Must be a big sucker. Based on the sizable area of disturbed vegetation, the Krestang's aircraft was much larger than a buzzard. Possibly some type of dropship. An interesting fact, but not relevant. She didn't need to know what type of ship the Krestang had. All she needed was to kill it.
Got it. Strebik, Bonsu, we have a target, she announced excitedly.
Just a minute, ma'am. Irene's voice grunted with strain. We just about have this... Oh, shit! I bashed my fingers.
You all right? Derek asked with concern.
Yeah, I'm fine, Irene said, sucking on her bruised fingers. That was stupid. Okay, that's the last one. Let's try it again.
She dropped to the ground and backed away from the engine.
Major Perkins, it's best if we're on the other side of the buzzard when this engine cranks. I can't guarantee a fan blade isn't going to go spinning away into the trees.
Derek got the damaged starboard engine started and ran it up to 5% power.
The vibration isn't bad, he reported. The dampeners are handling it.
Run it up, Irene ordered. The engine was capable of running at 65% of its maximum power before the vibration became unmanageable.
We'll keep it to 50% power, Irene suggested. With the missing fan blades, the engine gives up only,
she checked the remote control tablet,
35% of normal takeoff thrust. We lighten the bird,
she glanced at the pile of seats, spare parts, and everything else they had stripped out of the buzzard.
We're good. It will fly.
Yeah. Like a wounded duck, Derek observed with a frown.
Irene bit her lip, studying the site where Major Perkins thought the Krestang had hidden some type of aircraft.
It's doable. What do you think? She asked Derek.
Irene had flown a Black Hawk transport helicopter on Earth. Derek had been an attack pilot.
We can fly along this ravine, he traced a finger over the map. It gives cover from the mountaintop. When we pop up over this ridge, we'll be right on top of whatever aircraft they have. We should have,
he scratched his chin thoughtfully,
5 seconds.
From when we pop over the ridge to, impact. 5 seconds sounded like a long time to Perkins. If the Krestang are ready for it, they'll shoot the buzzard as soon as it clears the ridge. They won't know we're coming. Derek grinned with a wink. We'll fly low and slow enough along the ravine they won't see us and they won't hear us. The starboard engine is surprisingly quiet until the throttle is at 40% power. We'll keep it below that. This will work, Major. He looked up into Perkins's eyes. How confident are you this spot is where they park their aircraft? Perkins explained about the broken tree limbs. Yes, ma'am, Derek agreed. But if their pilots were smart, they would have sat down there, dropped off their people and equipment, then flown to a better spot to park their bird. Irene nodded. That's what we would do. Perkins suppressed a groan. She had been patting herself on the back for finding a stealthed alien aircraft, and her pilots were raining on her parade. Shit. If that's the case, it could be anywhere. They would only get one shot at using their crippled buzzard on a suicide mission. We'll stick with the plan. Was that the smart thing to do? 40,000 Ruhar and the fate of humans on Paradise might depend on whether she guessed correctly. It's the best we can do. They waited until Shauna sent a message that the drill bit was close to the power cells. Major Perkins shook her head in amazement at how short a time it had taken for the drill to reach that far through the volcanic rock of the island. Alien technology truly is incredible, she told herself. As soon as Shauna's signal was received, Perkins ordered the buzzard to be started and sent on its last mission. As Derek Bonsu predicted, the unbalanced aircraft flew like a wounded duck. What mattered was, it flew.
This narrow bandwidth signal is creating a serious time lag in the visuals, Irene warned, struggling with the remote control unit. I'm having to trust the map and anticipate turns in the ravine. The images I'm getting are behind by almost a second. The portside engine almost clipped a rock a second ago, she said, her eyes hidden behind the virtual reality goggles.
In order to prevent the Krestang detecting the remote control commands Irene was sending to the buzzard and the sensor data the buzzard was sending back, they were using a very low-power, compressed signal that mimicked background noise. That was great for avoiding detection, but terrible for accuracy. "Can you compensate?" Perkins asked anxiously. Shauna was holding the drill bit 60 meters from the power cells, fearful the Krestang had already discovered their activity. For the last 20 meters, the drill had been chewing through a vein of extra hard rock that required almost the full power of the drill. That hard rock would transmit vibrations the Krestang might detect.
I am doing that, ma'am.
Irene tried to keep the annoyance from her voice. Since she was Irene, it didn't work.
With this lag, I won't know exactly where the ship will be when it crests the ridge. I'm going to let the autopilot guide it to crash after I pull it above the ridge.
Use your best judgment, Perkins said tersely, fighting the knot in her stomach.
What the hell are they doing? Dave fumed.
Being a soldier, he was used to standing by to stand by, sitting around doing nothing while waiting for someone else to get off their asses. By extraordinary Herculean effort, which the U.S. Army would consider doing their jobs, they had wrestled the drill rig up a partly dry stream bed. Chopping branches off trees, fighting their way through dense underbrush that continuously snagged on the rig and scratched the three humans and one adolescent Ruhar on every piece of exposed skin. Thorns that were especially thick poked right through their army combat uniforms until they were all bloody here and there. All the time Dave had spent working with the drill rig had not changed his instinctive feeling that the six-legged machine was creepy. Watching it climb, its computer-guided legs almost intelligently feeling their way up the slope, had filled Dave with revulsion, as if the alien-built drill rig was a bloodthirsty insect crawling to bite him in half. When they got the rig into position, they had drilled down, then forward, chewing through soil, fractured shale, and solid volcanic rock, until Shauna judged they were close enough to the power cells that any more drilling would be detected. Dave was all for punching through the final meters into the power cells, hooking up the surge inducer and running like the wind. But no. Major Perkins ordered them to stand by while she and their two pilots did... what? What the hell could the three of them do with no weapons and a busted ship?
Be patient, Ski, Jesse replied quietly. The Major must have good reasons for whatever she's doing. She's been square with us all along. Hey, Pone, Perkins is good people. She's a grunt by association, but she's intel, not infantry. Our asses are hanging out to dry here.
He looked fearfully at the sky.